History is basically the story of people and events. Sometimes in history, the events are what govern the situation, and sometimes it's the force of the personality, if the person himself or herself, that forces the events and becomes the major focus of the historical event or the period that we're discussing, and the events recede almost into the background. In the review of the Tanakh that I've been doing over the past few lectures, we see, for instance, that during the time of the Shoftim, the events took over and governed the people. But when we come to the time of Shmuel, and we come to the time of Shaul, and now David and Shlomo, these are people who governed events, people whose biography and whose life story was of such import and so unique that it left a stamp not only on their generation, but a stamp on all later generations as well, on all of world history, on the entire story of human civilization. And because of that, emphasis has to be put on their personal biography, and that indirectly will teach us the historical events of the time. When David HaMelech comes to the fore after the death of Shaul, the Jewish people are on the verge again of chaos. And David is the single unifying force that finally brings the Jewish people together as a people, and that finally conquers the land of Israel and is able to eliminate the enemies both within and without. The Philistines, Amalek, Bnei Ammon, all the enemies, Aram from the area, all disappear during the time of David. And that's a combination of David's great efforts and a combination of God's hashgacha, naturally, of God's guidance in the world. But it was as though all these empires reached their peak and now they are all going downhill. And as they go downhill, then the Jewish empire, so to speak, ascends. It is able to rise. It's able to push itself. An understanding of how the rabbi saw David is based upon the fact that David is not seen as a personality, he is seen as the Jewish people. And as so often happens with the heroes, with the archetypes of the Jewish people, what happens to them is seen not only in the personal light, but it is seen in the national light. If we say regarding the Ovos, Maase Ovos, Simon Labonim, that what the forefathers did, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, that was only a signpost for what would happen later to their children, well, we could say that regarding David as well. David's life is exemplary of the Jewish people. And I hope to point that out to you by just a number of midrashim that one will be able to see how Jewish tradition viewed David. The first point is that according to Jewish tradition, David should never have existed, which again is a uniquely Jewish idea and is the way the Jewish people look at themselves, that on the basis of logic and historic perspective and rules and the way things should be, there shouldn't be any Jewish people. Now, rabbis phrase it the Ribbono Shel Olam, when he created man, exhibited to Adam HaRishon, to original man, all of the generations that would come from the beginning of time till the end. And that Adam HaRishon saw that this great person, David, was supposed to be stillborn. He had no life. He had no years that were granted to him. And original man, Adam HaRishon, realized that the world, that civilization, cannot exist without David. and therefore he gave him 70 years of his own life. And that's based on the idea that's mentioned many times, Odom im yichye elef shona, if a man lives 1,000 years. So original man was supposed to live 1,000 years. In the Bible, he is listed as having lived only 930 years. What happened to those 70 years? So the rabbis portray it in this sense, that he gave a gift of 70 years to David, so that David would be able to live. From here, we see a number of uniquely Jewish ideas. First of all, the idea that there can be a transference of years. We are accustomed to transferring property. In our time, there can even be transference of organs, of bits of the body. But no one has been able yet to define the method by which years are given. And yet we have many times in Jewish history, the last time that the famous story is told is about the great mayor of Lublin, the founder of the Lubliner Yeshiva, who died in the 1930s. He was a very young man, relatively speaking, died in his 40s. And when he was extremely ill and dying, so his students proclaimed a fast day, and they made an appeal for years. And people got up and donated years of their lives so that their master should live. Unfortunately, it didn't change the situation. But the concept, the idea that one can give years, that's a Jewish concept. And therefore, Odom Rishon gave to David HaMelech 70 years, the 70 years of his lifetime. So the idea is how important it is to have David in the world. And the other idea is how really on the basis of natural law, David should not exist, and hence the Jewish people should not exist. That's just an extension of that idea. David, as I mentioned to you last week, David was a lieutenant in Shaul's army. David was also a great hero because he had killed the giant Goliath. David was also a son-in-law of David Shaul because he was married for a period of time to Michal. David had the misfortune of being so talented and such an extraordinary person that he served as a lightning rod for all the jealousies and intrigues and hatreds and pettiness which many times accrue to people of value and to people of superior intent and to people of greatness. And David suffered all of his life from enemies. And most of the time, if not all the time, David was really blameless. He was guileless in the matter. And his enemies misjudged him. They read into his actions all sorts of negative things that were not present. Anyone who's a student of the Book of Tehillim, which is written by David, basically, there are 10 authors to Tehillim. David is only one of them. But most of the chapters are from David. We'll see that as a recurring theme. Over and over again, he says how my enemies have only sought to destroy me. They have never sought to make peace with me. They've never sought to understand me. They're not sensitive to what I'm trying to accomplish or to who I am. They've made up their minds in advance, and their minds have been made up in a negative fashion. All of his life he suffered from that, and he suffered from it from Shaul also. Shaul, in his melancholy, sees David as the source of all of his trouble, whereas, had he seen him correctly, David would have been the source of his salvation and that of the Jewish people and that of his government and of his family. Instead, he becomes very divisive. And David himself suffers from it to a great extent. All of his life is marked by the personal hostility which exists towards him from so many important people. Shaul's advisors, and then later on in life, David has it from his own advisors, and then he has it from his own children, two of whom mount rebellions against him in his lifetime. That's a terribly sobering description of what people are. Our rabbis, however, compared David to Moshe. The Talmud says in Yuma that there were two great leaders of the Jewish people, Moshe and David. And in that, the rabbis meant to tell us that there was no one that was able to unify the Jewish people as David was. And I think that one could approach it, how was he able to unify them? Because David was really all things to all men. He rarely have a combination in a person that he was. David is the great Talmud Chochem, the great scholar. He is listed in the chain of tradition of Torah. He's the great scholar in Torah. The Gemara mentions that every day he sat in the Bezdin, he sat in the court of law, in the court of the yeshiva, and delivered the lecture and answered the questions. And he was the one that was responsible for Torah. Now, when we think of a Rosh Yeshiva, we don't think of a Rosh Yeshiva that plays guitar or the violin. Or if he does, at least he doesn't do it publicly. Or if he does, he did it, but he doesn't do it anymore. David is the great musician of the Jewish people. Our rabbis ascribe to him, in fact, inventions of musical instruments, stringed instruments. And that his skill as a musician was an enormous facet of his personality. It was part of him. And that he gained favor with Saul originally, not because of his abilities as a warrior, as an administrator, but simply his abilities as a musician. He played for him. When he was melancholy, he was able to play music and remove the melancholia, remove the depression from him. So that's a different facet of David, completely different. Our rabbis tell us that David was one of the most powerful human beings, physically powerful. That he was able to bend the bow. He was the champion in being able to bend the bow, which in the ancient world was always the measure of great strength. And really the ability to bend the bow, he who could bend the bow the most, was the most valuable person in the army, but that also was the sign of enormous strength. And our rabbis say that David's arms were like copper, like iron. His muscles, he was a tremendously physically powerful person, something which we also do not usually associate with Torah scholarship. Most of our Torah scholars have been people that are not necessarily physically imposing or physically powerful. And especially over the last period of time, Eastern European Jewry was not noted for being tall or strong. And the Jews suffered from malnutrition and from other problems, were always aware of their physical limitations. David is an exception. He's the speediest racer. He is the strongest bowman. He's the most powerful person. So that's another facet of his personality. Then he's the king, with all that goes with being the king. Not only being the king, he is the king, David Melech Yisrael. He is the symbol of Jewish monarchy. Everything that it says in the Bible regarding a monarch and everything that the Jewish tradition had been what the monarch would be, so Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, was unable to live up to that build-up. He was unable to be the king whom they had hoped would solve their problems and unify the country. And really, in his short two-year reign, it's a time of tragedy more than a time of accomplishment. But David, in his 40-year reign, is the king. He is the man that expands the borders. He is the one that develops trade and a stable, sound economy. He is the one that forces all of Israel's enemies to put down the sword and make peace with her. He expands the country, as I mentioned, to its ultimate boundaries. All of the western part and a great deal of the eastern part across the Jordan, all the way up into the Golan, all the way up into Aram, which is today Syria and Lebanon, all of that belongs to David. And that's really a great contribution. And that's a hero, a national hero. So that's another facet of him. So when you put all the pieces of David together, you have a most complex person. But you have a person that, Lahavdil, but we would say it in today's terms, a Renaissance man. You have a man that's everything for everybody. On top of it, the rabbis saw David, and the Jewish people saw David as a truly righteous person. Here you have an interesting facet of life, a piece of psychology. There can be a person that never does anything wrong, but deep down everybody knows that he's not a righteous person. He really isn't a God-fearing person. He really isn't a good person. It's somehow tainted by either insincerity or by over-sophistication or by playing a role. But that's not it. It's what I would characterize as a professional tzaddik. There are people who have, that's their profession. There are people who are doctors, and people who are lawyers, there are people who are tzaddikim by profession. And that's why the rabbis say, and the Jewish legend is rather, that there are 36 tzaddikim in the world who support the world. But the common denominator of all 36, that nobody knows who they are, and they don't know that they're one of the 36. I imagine that if you know you're one of the 36, then you aren't. And David, who in the stories in the Tanakh, is not exonerated from certain failings and from events which are not necessarily complimentary to him. And in fact is painted in not only very human, but in very critical relief in the Tanakh. And nevertheless, David is the tzaddik. David's righteousness is unquestioned. And the fact that a tzaddik may at times do things that are questionable does not apparently change his status of being a tzaddik. And that's, again, a uniquely Jewish outlook. And the portrayal of David in this light gives it, gives it more meaning. Our rabbis say that David was a great singer, aside from a musician. He had a beautiful voice. And all of this combines in one person. So that that's why you could unite the Jewish people. Because for the masses he was a hero, and for the scholars he was a hero, and for the pious people he was a hero, and for the ordinary people he had something, and on top of it he got the job done, which is in a leadership role is 75-80% of the judgment. You can have the greatest person in the world, but if the job doesn't get done, so then we're not too happy with it. David got the job done. During his time, all of the enemies of the Jewish people are defeated, and his reign, which is 840 years after the time that the Jewish people left Egypt, I'm sorry, that's not correct, 440 years after the time that the Jewish people left Egypt, so he culminates that entire 440-year period. He brings the Jewish people to where they're supposed to be. Originally, he was the king over only the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. and his capital city was in Hebron, the city of Hebron, which was the capital city of Judah, the tribe of Judah. And he himself was born in the city of Beis Lechem, the city of Bethlehem, which was a small village as it is today, which was near Yerushalayim, but Yerushalayim itself belonged to the Yebusi. It was a Jebusite fortress. It was not a major city, but it was a Jebusite fortress that in the entire 400 years that the Jews were in the land of Israel, they were never able to conquer. And Jerusalem, by its topography, by its nature, is a very, very difficult city to reach. It's a very difficult city to conquer. It's surrounded by mountains. It just is a very strategically located place, and the Jews were unable to dislodge the Yebusi from there. David, when he does, David purchases a great deal of the city, and the part that he could not purchase, he conquers. And when he conquers it, then the prophet comes and says, this is the city. This is the place that God has chosen. Because in the Chumash, we have no reference to Jerusalem directly in the Bible. It just says that there will come a time when the Jewish people will be united. Hamokom asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha. The place where the Lord your God will choose, that will be the holy place in the land of Israel, and there you'll build the temple, and that'll be the place of central government and central worship. Could have been any place. But during the entire 400 years that the Jews were in Palestine, they found no such place, and the prophets did not invest any place with that holiness. And even though, for instance, the Mishkan was at the city of Shiloh for centuries, but Shiloh was never known to be the place of holiness. And during the entire time that the Ark was there and that the Mishkan was there, the Jewish people knew that it was temporary. Yerushalayim was the city. Yerushalayim was the place. And David is the one that conquered it, and David is the one that established it. We have the name Yerushalayim based on two names which appear in the Torah. One is the name that our father Abraham gave to the place at the moment after the Akedah. It says, Asher Yomar Bayomahu Bahar Hashem Yeroyah. In the mountain of God, Yeroyah will be seen. So Yeroyah is the first part of Yerushalayim. And the second part is Sholem, Malki Tzedek Melech Sholem, which was the name of the city, Salem. That was the name. So the Ribbono Shalom didn't want to choose between the two names, so he combined. The Jewish people have combined the names. And that it became Yerushalayim and Yerushalayim. So David conquers Yerushalayim, and David has within himself the grand idea, the master purpose, that now that he's conquered Yerushalayim, he's going to make it into the capital city, into the imperial city. If you go today to the southern excavations, archaeological excavations outside the southern walls of Jerusalem, you can see the palace that they say is King David's. If it is not David's palace itself, it is a palace of the time of David. That the archaeologists have been able to establish. They've been able to unearth most of the staircase that led up to it. He made it an imperial city. He built it. And it was called Ir David, the city of David. It was associated with him. And the city of David did not run where the present city of Jerusalem is. The city of David was a little farther to the east and farther to the south, and it ran as a long, narrow city into the valley. And the valley is called the Ophel. And that was the area where David HaMelech and the Jews lived during the time when they developed Jerusalem. And later on, Jerusalem built upon the hills. It expanded farther west and farther north. Today, most of the city is west of where it was, certainly in biblical times, even in the times of the Mishnah and the Talmud. So David, when he moves to Yerushalayim, has the idea to build the Beis HaMikdash. He wants to build the temple as well. Our rabbis intimate, it's not said clearly, but the intimation is that if David would have built it, could have built it, somehow if it would have been built, it would not have been destroyed. We have the same intimation regarding Moshe, that if Moshe would have been the one that took the Jewish people into the land of Israel, and then the Jewish people would not have ever gone into exile. They would not have ever been able to be dislodged. But Moshe didn't take us in. And when Moshe didn't take us in, then historical possibilities occurred, which unfortunately became realized. Well, the same thing is true regarding David. Had David built the Beis HaMikdash, there would have been within it an immunity to destruction. But he didn't build it. And because he didn't build it, so other historical opportunities arose, which unfortunately came to be. God himself prevents David from building the Beis HaMikdash. It's almost a direct interference of God in history. And God ascribes the reason, as we read it in the Tanakh, in Divrei Yomim especially, the reason being that because David was involved in war, he was a man of war, he had killed many people, he had caused many people to be killed. And that the Beis HaMikdash, which was and is the symbol of peace and of tranquility, it would be unseemly that a person that was so engaged in war should be the one that should be the builder of the Beis HaMikdash. And the truth of the matter is his son Shlomo almost engaged in no wars. And therefore he was the one to build the Beis HaMikdash. However, the credit for building the Beis HaMikdash is given to David. It becomes part of David's own personality. And when the Beis HaMikdash is finally dedicated, so our rabbis tell us the famous medrash based upon the psalm that the doors wouldn't open, right? They had the same kind of builder that some of us have, right? The doors didn't open. After paying, you know, $40 trillion for the whole thing, they can't open the doors. And you have the entire Jewish people gathered for the building, for the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash and to celebrate Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, and he can't get the doors open. So he prayed, Shlomo prays to God, but until he invokes Schor Chasdei David Ovi, remember the goodness of my father David, until he puts David's name on the building, so to speak, then nothing happens. When that happens, then the building is dedicated, then the door is open. And the Beis HaMikdash can be dedicated. So it is on David, because David was the moving force, and David was the one that, more than anyone else, saw to it that the Beis HaMikdash should be built. In fact, we see it in the Tanakh, and we see it throughout the rabbis, that David assembled the materials to the extent that he could. And he put money aside in the treasury, and he laid the psychological and economic foundation which was necessary in order to build the Beis HaMikdash. When you build a building, especially a religious building, especially a major religious building for a community, so it takes much more than just bricks and stones or a mortgage. Because there has to be a communal preparation, there has to be a psychological predisposition towards the building. And that David accomplished, not Shlomo, but David himself accomplished. David was a very wily negotiator, especially with not only his enemies, but with the enemies of the Jewish people. Is a line that we see throughout David's career, he himself stated, that im chochom tischakom, with a wise man, then you can behave wisely. And with a righteous person, you can behave righteously. But with an evil person, im novol tisnavor, then you have to be as clever as he is, as cunning as he is, as devious as he is. Because otherwise, the righteous and the good are exposed to the level of the evil, and they are unable to maintain themselves in the world. And it's very hard to be Mr. Nice Guy when people are batting your brains in. And David was able to create himself, to create within himself the ability to deal that way, and it should not impinge on his personality. It should not make him a cruel person. But that's part of his greatness. David is also represented in the Talmud as being the most industrious of kings. We find that King Solomon says it. We find it generally throughout the Tanakh and throughout the Talmud that people that take very long lunches disturb Chazal. It just bothers them. Today I tried to reach someone at a certain bank, which will go nameless. So I called at 11:30, and they said, Mr. So-and-so just stepped out to lunch. I called at 2 o'clock, he didn't come back yet. At 2:30, he came back for lunch. So I was flippant. I said to him, gee, you had a long lunch today. So he says, listen, he says, I'm entitled. He said, you know, like he took it personally. So I saw that probably wasn't the first time that he had a 3-hour lunch. And the Talmud describes for us the schedule of David HaMelech. David HaMelech only slept 2 hours out of 24. I have grandchildren like that. He only slept 2 hours out of 24, and the Talmud says he never slept more than 30 minutes at a time. He took 4 30-minute naps. I've seen there's a sleep center that measures what people need to sleep in different patterns. There's a fascinating phenomena, sleep generally. But it seems to be correct that a half hour of deep sleep is enough for us, right? The rest is like extra. But since our sleeping patterns are of such a nature, they're rarer is the person that can get along with very little sleep without it damaging him. But David, during his entire adult life, the Talmud says, slept 2 hours out of 24. The disciples of the Gaon of Vilna testify to the same thing much later, that the Gaon, for the last 40 years of his life, only slept 2 hours a day, and also slept only in 4 one-half-hour increments, which is a mind-boggling type of situation. But we see that David himself said it, that other kings get up 10 in the morning, he says, and I'm going from the crack of dawn. Other people go to sleep early, I'm up at midnight. He had a magic harp that the wind blew, and the harp awakened him at midnight, and that was his time of composition and prayer and song to God. So David is represented as a most industrious person, and that was meant to be a role model for all Jewish leaders, to work hard and long. And that's not an easy trait to develop. David respected wisdom and wise men. He even respected wise men who didn't merit it, so to speak, in their behavior towards him. David was always bigger than that. In the Pirkei Avos, we read the famous statement that a person that learns something from someone else, so he owes him a measure of respect for that person having taught him something. And the the Mishnah brings a proof from David, that from Achitophel, who later became his advisor, and not only his advisor, but later became an enemy of his and was treacherous to him and tried to destroy him. So David learned two things from him. And because he learned two things from him, he gave him a title. He called him Rabbi Alufium Yudoi, my teacher, my master, who is greater than I am, and Yudoi, the one who imparted to me knowledge, the one who gave me knowledge. What were the two things that he learned from him? That's the kasha that they always ask, right? No, they don't always ask it. I was in yeshiva, I always used to ask, what are the two things that David learned from him? So one thing was that you have to learn b'chavrusa. You shouldn't learn by yourself. That was one thing that he learned from him. That the optimum way to learn Torah is to learn Torah with a companion. Because of the fact that the interplay of two minds, hopefully there are two minds, but the interplay of two minds and two personalities, so it develops it. If you're learning by yourself, then there's no one to criticize your pattern. There's no one to criticize your thoughts. There's no one to criticize your contribution. There's no one to say, well, what your explanation is wrong, or it's not right, or it doesn't make sense. But if two people learn together, so that's one thing he learned, that the Torah requires more than, it's not an individual effort alone. And the second thing he told him is that when you go to the synagogue to pray, you should run there. Don't walk slowly, you should run. By us, it's usually reverse, right? Chazal phrase it in their inimitable fashion, that the Jewish people are, when they leave the synagogue or when they leave the Beis HaMedrash, it's ketina kaboreach mebeis haSefer. It's like the child leaving school. You ever stand in front of the school when the bell rings, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, you know, you get trampled. They're all out in a second. Try it the last day of school. That's the image of the Jewish people also. We are, you know, it's over, right? Get out. Goodbye. And Achitophel taught him that one should run to and walk away from. So those are really two minor lessons, right? I mean, I wouldn't call somebody Rabbi Alufi Miyodoi. I mean, if he told me a great philosophical idea, or he explained to me a complicated idea in Torah that I didn't know before, so then I would say, okay, then I owe him something. But for telling me to run to shul, or telling me that it's better to learn two than to learn one, so it's not so great. But Chazal saw in it the personality of David, the personality of respect for wisdom, for intellect, for knowledge. And that's a hallmark of the Jewish people, not a hallmark of David himself. In effect, David tells God, and God answers him in kind. David says, listen, I'll sit and learn Torah and you fight the wars. Now, that's another uniquely Jewish idea. And the idea is based that the economy, we all have to do the best that we can, but ultimately what we do is dependent upon what God wills. In Yiddish, there's a great phrase, "Der Rebbeinu Shelem vil shista bezem." If God wants to, then a broom is a cannon. And if God wants to, then the cannon is a broom, and then it's not going to help you either. And I always tell the story of my good friend, the stockbroker, who made a fortune by buying the wrong stock. He was nervous, and he was going to buy GM, and he bought GE, and it turned out that he was a genius. Well, every person has in his or her lifetime mistakes that we have made that have turned out to be fortuitous, and brilliant things that we have done that have turned out to be disastrous. So David says to God, really, he says, I'm going to sit and learn. You know, you take care, you know. Let the government, you'll take care of the wars. You'll take care of the government. You'll take care of the economy. That's a typically Jewish attitude. It's hard to sell that attitude. it's hard to sell it to parents. You know, the kid comes home and says, you know, that's all right. You know, God's going to help. Oh, boy. We want him to, you know, we want him to have a profession. We want to, how are you going to make a living? How are you going to support? We want to, especially a parent who himself or herself never had that security. And that's true regarding the Jewish people and regarding the Jewish state and regarding everything Jewish. You know, we want to see, you know, are you going to open, you're going to open a school? Where are you, how are you going to support it? Where are your students? Where are you, what are you going to do? Who's going to come? Well, if we made those types of reckoning, then nothing would ever happen. From time immemorial, nothing would ever happen. On the other hand, wildly impractical things also bomb. I mean, you want to make a Jewish school, I wouldn't recommend doing it in Amman. I mean, there are limits. And to go out and hire a staff and people and commit yourself to $1 million budget and you don't have a dime one, so that's really not correct either. So there is a line somewhere. But the Talmud expresses the line through David that it's all, that you can lay it on God. And that's again based on the famous verse, Hashlech al Hashem Yehovcho v'hu yechal kaleko. Throw your package on God and he'll feed you. I always think of that when I go to the airport. So there are escalators, especially in Newark, there are escalators to the, from the baggage where you come in on the lower level and you have to go up to the gates to the ticketing level. So they have escalators. So there are people that are holding luggage. And as they stand on the escalator, they're still holding the luggage. Put the luggage down to the escalator's going anyway. What do you have to schlep, right? It's going, you know, you're... What's making you go? The escalator's making you go, so let them carry the luggage too. Well, that's the idea in the verse, Hashlech al Hashem. David says, put the package on God, right? He's carrying you anyway. Let him carry the package. It's going anyway. That's a typically Jewish attitude. That's part of David's tradition to the Jewish people. And the rabbis phrase it that was, so to speak, his policy. And what was his foreign policy? His foreign policy was to sit and learn Torah. So you say, don't worry, right? Don't worry, worry about Schultz. And next time you should send Rav Shach here instead of Shamir, right? What's going to happen? Well, why is it any better, right? Why, is it any better when the diplomats do it? Is it any better? There's no way out anyway. And that, if you don't understand, and you don't have to agree with it, but you have to at least understand that that's part of the Jewish package. That's the way Jews traditionally have looked at the world. And that's the way David ran his government. And because of that, I think that allowed him to be the type of personality that he was. Almost a naive, simple faith which is represented by David in such a complex person, and a person with so many talents and with such intellectual ability and everything, and that he should be that simple and that naive when it comes to matters of faith, that's the truly Jewish viewpoint. That's why David is above all the other kings who were statesmen and noblemen and world leaders and presidents of the OAS and all sorts of other things. David's naivete almost strikes us as being fascinating, interesting, and of great moment, great purpose for us. The greatest accomplishment of David probably is the Book of Tehillim. The Book of Tehillim is so important in Jewish life. Our rabbis say that the five books of Tehillim is divided, Psalms is divided into five sections. That's like the five sections of the Torah. And our rabbis tell us that if a Jew doesn't have time to study Torah, or he doesn't have the ability to study Torah, merely reading Psalms equals it. And throughout Jewish history, there were people who were called Tehillim Jews. Every day they would say chapters of Tehillim. So Tehillim is divided into daily sections and into monthly sections, into weekly sections. But a Jew never went anywhere without Tehillim. I think that's one of the terrible losses in our time, in the sophistication and in the great learning in the yeshivas and in everything else that we've become, is that we've forgotten about that. And that is an element of strength and of faith and of warmth and of goodness that's sorely missing. And it's almost like one would be embarrassed, you know, to sit down and say Tehillim. So we reserve the saying of Tehillim, God forbid, for tragic occasions. A person is ill, so we say Tehillim on behalf of his recovery. At a funeral, God forbid, so Tehillim is recited. But, on a good day, when you're on the way to the office, you're in the car and you call up on the car phone and you're working already, so Tehillim is not seen as part of the package. But in reality, throughout Jewish history, from the time of David HaMelech on, Tehillim is, the Book of Psalms, is the arsenal of faith. Because in the Book of Tehillim, which is very personal, you can read David HaMelech's biography and his incidents and how he views life and all the problems that faced him in the book of Tehillim. He says it to you. This is the psalm that he said when Saul pursued him. And this is the psalm that he said when he had to flee from his son Avshalom. And this is what he said when his child died. And this is what he said in rebellion. And this is what he said on the day that he dedicated the palace. And this is what he said. So you know, you have a complete picture of the person. Everything that he says personally, almost every Jew can empathize with, and it becomes part of us, and it's as though it were written for me. That's the great lasting quality to it, the genius of it. The comparison, it's not a good comparison, but I like to state it anyway. For instance, Shakespeare is great literature. There's no question it's great literature. But Shakespeare is great literature, but it doesn't do much for the person. I mean, your association with Shakespeare is not personal. There are parts of Shakespeare, for instance, when in the speeches or the soliloquies, he expresses the thoughts of every man, which is really his genius. But it has never become a form of common human expression. The Book of Psalms is common human expression. For every occasion, there's a psalm, there's a verse, there's a saying. And that has remained that way throughout the history of the Jewish people. It is the book. It's the book that carried us. And it's the book that became the part and parcel of Jewish life. And there really was no Jewish synagogue throughout the world where the recitation of Psalms was not part of the daily ritual of the Jewish people. Sephardim, Ashkenazim. You go in Eretz Yisrael today, Shabbos in the afternoon, in Yerushalayim, there are entire clubs of children who gather together and read Psalms the entire afternoon. Well, it may not sound like a very good time, or not be very exciting, but it's an element in life that stands a person in very good stead. And that was the Book of Psalms. That's David HaMelech's major contribution, this book that he wrote. And as I mentioned to you, there are 9 other authors besides David, including Adam Arishon, original man, the Psalm of Mizmor Shir Liyom HaShabbos is Adam Arishon, Moshe Rabbeinu is an author, Avraham Avinu is an author, Malki Tzedek is an author. They have all sorts of authors, the B'nai Korach, Hamon, Yedusun, all they're a mention. They're 10 different authors. But it's David's book. It's Mizmor LeDavid. And David has that quality that he was able to not only to humanize it, but it became so human that everybody could identify with David. The enmity to David, which I mentioned before, is important to dwell on because historically it is the single greatest weakness within the Jewish people. It is the thing that destroyed us and continues to destroy us. It's not just a lack of unity. You don't have to think the way I do. And you don't have to agree with everything that I say, though you'd be foolish not to. But there's no reason for you to hate me because I say something that you don't agree with. And there's no reason for you to impute to me evil motives. And there's no reason for you to suspect of the worst of me simply because of the fact that I may not agree with you. And that combination of jealousy and hatred and what Chazal calls sinas chinam, futile hatred for no reason, has been the undoing of the Jewish people throughout the ages. And David is the example. For instance, I always mention the famous Gemara in Shabbos that David had somebody, Shimi ben Gera, who David had befriended naturally and had done him favors and had fed him. And then in the war with Avshalom, he deserted David and he went over on the side of Avshalom and he cursed David, cursed him terribly. So in the Tanakh, it doesn't say what the curse is. In the Tanakh, it just says, "Hu kilalani klolo nimretzes." He said a bitter curse to me. But our rabbis darshan the word nimretzes, nun mem reish tzadik tof, to tell us what he said about David. Nimretzes, the nun is noef. David was an adulterer. The mem is Moavi. He's not even Jewish. He's descended from Rus. His pedigree is not in order. The reish is rotzeach. He's a murderer. Look at all the people that he killed. The tzaddik is tzorer. He's a tyrant. He's an oppressor. He's a despot. And the tof is toevo. He's an abomination. Well, I mean, that's a pretty big bill of particulars. That isn't just, you know, that he doesn't daven with a gartel. I mean, that's serious things. And he's talking about David, the king of Israel. But that's why it's nimretzes. Because each of those items is a misstatement. It's true. If you look at it, there's room to say that maybe that's the problem. But if you know David, and if you're sensitive to him, and you're aware of what the problems are, and how David behaves, and what the Jewish people are, then you see that David is above all of that. And you purposely chose to drag him down, you purposely chose to accuse him in such a fashion, that's a bitter, bitter curse. That's a curse that David can't forgive him for. Because of the fact that it has all of those terrible qualities to it. But you see the type of opposition that he had. So today we imagine, you know, if David came, let's announce that David is coming, you know, Madison Square Garden. So it'd be sold out. Everybody would come and cheer and want to hear what he has to say and see how great he is. That's only in our time, not in his time. The phrase that there is no prophet in his city, which is not taken from Jewish origins, but it's been adopted by the Jews, can also be rephrased, there is no prophet in his time either. And the generation that lived with David didn't see David. They didn't see him in his historic perspective. They didn't see what was going to happen. And that's true in every generation, and it's true of every leader. It's true, I think, of every person. You just don't see it. The example that's given is viewing a mountain. If you stand right next to the mountain, so then you cannot see it. You cannot see how tall it is, and you cannot see how imposing it is. You go 30 miles away, 50 miles away. The greatest view I ever had of a mountain in my life was when I flew from Japan, from Tokyo to Tehran, with an unscheduled stop in Peking, which is a different story. Then it was Peking, now it's Beijing, but then it was Peking. So when the plane takes off and it leaves Tokyo Airport and he climbs to the altitude, you see Mount Fuji, Fujiyama in Japan. It was an absolutely clear day and you could see it was just awe-inspiring because it's not a mountain that's surrounded by other mountains, it's not hidden by anything, and you're 20,000 feet in the air, and you're as tall as the mountain, practically, and you're able to see it in all of its grandeur. Well, people are like that also. Leaders are like that also. David today is the mountain. We look back at him, we realize there would be no Jewish people without David. No Jewish nation. David is the Mashiach. David is our hope for the future. David is everything. But in his time, in his place, when his contemporaries, you know, he was just good old Dave. He was nobody. Nobody was, and you see from the depths of the enmity towards him, the difficulty of the situation, how difficult it was to overcome, how difficult it was to accomplish. As I mentioned to you, and I say it now in conclusion, David was able to bring the Jewish people to the highest point in their history, in the entire history of the Jewish people. The last years of David and the first years of Solomon, that's the high point. Our rabbis say it was such a high point that the world clamored to convert to Judaism. They closed the doors. They wouldn't accept any more converts. Because the Jews were on top in the world, and there was no way to know the sincerity of the people any longer. They just closed the doors. But you had finally domestic tranquility. You had economic wealth. For the first time, Jewish people were wealthy, and they were ensconced in their own homeland, and they were freed from the fears of their enemies. And they came to a spiritual attainment, which is represented not only in the book of Tehillim, but represented in the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. And Kaviyochel, God's physical manifestation, now will be present among the Jewish people. The Shekhinah will dwell in their midst. That's the tremendous accomplishment. And during the time of David, we have a plethora of prophets, of great prophets, God and David and God, and Noson, and Shmuel was when in his time, and other prophets who were able to raise the Jewish people to a level of understanding, of sincerity. The oral law was developed to a stronger extent. The educational system was buttressed. It's the golden age, of all of Jewish history. Only lasted a short period of time. According to Chazal, it's only 25 years, 30 years. It's one generation. Because by the end of the reign of King Solomon, it's all falling apart already. But for that one period of time, that's why he's the Melech HaMashiach. That's the forerunner of what it'll look like. That's the goal to shoot for again. That's the type of existence, the type of country, and the type of society, and the type of Jewish people that we're looking for. So when we say when the Mashiach comes, you know, everything will be in order, we're not talking utopia. We're talking an ability to restore ourselves to the level that we were in during the time of King David, to restore ourselves to the level that the Jewish people achieved then. And that level was of such a nature and had such power and strength to it that it became the goal for the Jewish people for all ages and all times. And therefore, that's why Chazal say that David is the Mashiach. It's not David personally, but David is representative of everything that a Mashiach, and the Mashiach is his descendant, just as the Jewish people are his descendants, because only through David has Jewish history been able to continue till today.